What I want to do first is I want to tell you a little bit about this case. And as I go through what the facts are, I'm going to highlight some things for you so you can see how they play out in the testimony itself. Now, my style of being an expert witness is not to present case after case after study after study after study, details after details after details. What I say is I want to present the broad picture with principles that have arisen out of a community of replicated research. So for the first, most of the talk, you are not going to really hear a lot about individual studies, but because this is the kind of colloquium you're used to getting used to and to studies, we are going to have the very end where I will show you some of the kinds of studies that have been done to bolster the evidence that I generally give in the court. So let's start with the case. It involved a defendant who was at the time 13 years old, Andy, who babysat for children on the block. And the first child is Janie, and she told her grandmother that Andy touched her genitals a year ago. The grandmother questions Janie, tells the mom sets up an interview with the police, and five days later, she goes to the police. And she told the police, a summary is that she repeated the disclosure, and she extended it to say that he had me put my hand in his panties, he took his shorts off, he was sitting down, he told me to search in his panties. I kind of felt his teaching. That's done. The mom then tells the police that there's another family that they should be interviewing because that other family had had Andy as a babysitter a year previously or more. That's where she got him from. So that family has a bunch of kids, but the two oldest are questioned on multiple times by their parents if anything happened. And they repeatedly say for a period of 6 or 7 months that nothing happened. And finally, the DA calls and says, you know, we really got to get this case together. Maybe you can talk to your kids again. So in February, the mom talks to the girls, and they do disclose some kind of genital touching or wrongdoing by Andy. Then they go to have a formal interview. One of the child really says nothing. Another child, the younger one, discloses some. We wait a year. We have more attempts. The children disclose to their mom. They go back to the forensic interview. One of the child discloses something, not much, and the other one elaborates. They go to trial in 2007. During that trial, the children and their families testify. I was the expert witness to talk about the reliability of the children's statements, and it resulted in a verdict of innocence. And that's the end. So what I want to do now is I want to talk about the findings. This is kind of the defense case. What I want to do is I want to talk about the findings, specific findings that we found as we went through the record, and how I use these to develop my testimony. And so these are the main points that we're going to deal with. So here's what happens. It's not true, or this child's disclosure, the first child's disclosure, really, we don't think came out of nowhere. There was an effect of social contagion whereby the mothers in the neighborhood would get together, and it came out through neighborhood conversations that the mother of the two younger children had told the other mothers that Andy had taken her older child upstairs to have a shower that was not needed. They also discussed a game similar to something called hide and seek, whereby Andy, and they called it hide the monkey. And that comes out in the first child's testimony. So there is, in fact, a backdrop against which this child's statements could be seen. Next, the grandmother elicits this testimony, and the next day she actually writes a summary of what the child said. And it goes something like this, which is, if you look at it, sounds okay, but let's point out some things. The daughter says, the little girl says, why do boys shake themselves after they go tee-tee? First of all, she has two older brothers and a dad. Grandmother says, what are you talking about? She said she had seen them do this at school. I asked her if she had seen, seen this at school. Well, she already said yes. But anyway, thinking she might have gone in the wrong restroom, she said that it was at home. I thought maybe she walked on and someone, but she said no. Andy left the door open. Now, I don't know how the conversation with Andy came up because she hasn't seen Andy for a year. And then it goes on. The grandmother starts talking about more. I asked her this, I asked her that. And she says that she loves Andy and not to tell her mother it was a secret. And the grandmother says, I asked her if he put his hands in her panties and she said, I didn't think so. So there was no allegation at this point. And then the mother comes and questions the child. Mother falls apart, questions the child that night several times. And during that conversation, the mother asks about the shape of Andy's penis. And 5 days later, they go to this interview with the police. And we have a video recording of it. And the child repeats some of the disclosures. She elaborates. And she now says, I kind of felt his titty. This does not appear in the police report. What the police report says, she said he touches her pee-pee. So with that, we start these other children. And what happened was that they repeatedly called the mother to keep urging her to question the children. And this was really at the behest of the first mother, who, it turns out, used to work in the district attorney's office, and as it turns out, did have some kind of grudge about this family for political reasons. Finally, the mother of the young children tells them to stop calling, that the children are in therapy, as it turns out, for something else, and the therapist says they shouldn't bring up the abuse. So they actually don't call for about 5 weeks, and finally the assistant district attorney calls because the mother is pushing him, and she requests additional information. And that's where the mother then starts talking to the girls. And we have descriptions from the mother of long interviews with these children where they're distraught, they're breaking out into tears, and the youngest child does make an allegation that Andy pulled down his pants and he grabbed her hand and made her touch him. While she's saying this, she's crying and it's late at night and they're watching television. And when that's finished, the two girls and the mother go to Janie's house where they meet Janie and the mother. They discuss the allegations. The three girls go off and the oldest girl tells the other two about, don't be afraid, it's okay, you're going to go to the place where they're going to interview you, this is what they're going to say. So we have a large hand here of contamination. And when we look at what the children say in the interviews, the official interviews in 205 and 206, what we see is that Nancy, the oldest one of these children, says that Andy was never there in the shower with her and that nothing happened. And the younger child said that she talks about the monkey game, and the monkey game was put something in his pocket, they made her reach in and she felt his titty or whatever they called it, and she said it happened only one time. The problem is, and this doesn't appear in any of the reports, is that when she's asked about the human anatomy and what part is what, she can't figure out what's what. She calls it the belly button, she calls it the bottom. The interviewer gets very mixed up and says, well, just let's forget about it. But they use that as positive evidence. So they leave them alone, and then the mother is still at them. And this time, a year later, she gets Nancy to say that Andy lifted up her dress and tickled her upper thigh above her panties. The younger sister walks in. She says, this is just what she told me. You know, now it's your time to tell. And this goes on for a while. And the little child sees that if she can sit on her mother's lap, this is a good way to talk about it. So again, she tells about touching. And this time she says it happened 4 or 5 times. And again, they go off to the official interview. And this time, the older child, Nancy, makes no claims of abuse. She just said, he was tickling on my pants. And the younger child made claims and elaborated them. About 3 days into trial, the prosecution hands over some new discovery, which happens to be the 3 children's therapy records. For Janie, Janie, who is the oldest of them, her therapy started immediately after she made allegations. She wasn't really concerned about what was going on in her home. She was more concerned about her playmates. But she did talk about, you know, peeking under the door and seeing her father in the bathroom. She talks about talking to Nancy and Rosie about what they said. And in fact, there's this one thing that says, she says to the therapist, at least Andy did not make me take a shower. So these little children are going back and forth. The other 2 children went in to therapy because of OCD. And it wasn't because of any sexual abuse. And at the beginning, the therapist really didn't think that this was connected at all to sexual abuse. And they got all the information about sexual abuse from the mother, who kept saying, you know, are you sure it's not this? You're sure it's not this? And that's when the therapist said to the mom, there's no more discussion about this. We're not talking about this. But a few months later, actually, the therapist started thinking about, you know, maybe the kids are sexually abused, and they start questioning the kids in the therapy session about it, sometimes in the presence of the mom. The one thing that we only found out at the very end was the younger child, her behavior gets worse and worse. She's physically aggressive. Her parents are angry at her. And the solution is to talk about the causes of her problems. And by trial, her behavior is so terrible, she's not allowed in any after-school programs. So what I wanted you to see is that from this, these are the themes that I have extracted that are pertinent to the research that I've done, that we have an empirical basis for talking about, and which can provide a framework for understanding what's going on in this case. So I think that that's the end. And now, against this, we now have a direct examination. And I'm not going to get qualified, because Steve said I was allowed to give this talk, so we don't need a qualification. And I'm ready, and I swear to tell the truth.
Dr. Brock, as an expert in memory and suggestibility, I would first like to ask you a series of questions regarding patterns of disclosure in children who we suspect who have potentially been abused. And so can you describe to the jury your research and expertise and experience in this area?
Right. So my colleagues and I, Steve Cici was one, Cami London another, we researched the evidence for something that's called child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. That is a huge construct that's used in the world of sexual abuse to explain why children might deny abuse and not tell. And it goes something like this. Children don't talk about abuse. They keep it a secret. They're ashamed. They're embarrassed. And it takes them a long time to disclose. And sometimes they'll disclose, but sometimes they'll actually take it back and there's recantation. So it's not unusual for children not to tell for a long time. It's not unusual for children to deny and deny and deny. And it's not unusual for children then to maybe make a statement and then take it back. So that's the governing wisdom that permeates the clinical world. So what we wanted to do was to see how much empirical evidence is there for this statement. And we did a large review of the literature, and this is basically what we found. The first thing is that yes, it is true that children do not disclose, many children do not disclose sexual abuse. Sometimes sometimes it never gets disclosed. But what was, and these are from studies of adults who claim that they were victims of child abuse. So they go back and they say, you know, so this happened to you, did you ever tell anybody? And when did you tell anybody and when did, so it's a compilation of all these studies that comes to this idea that there is secrecy. And sometimes, and these studies average 30% of the people interviewed said they never told anybody till they were interviewed for this study. But those studies never ask the question, well, did anybody ever ask you? Because that's what denial is. Denial is, you know, were you abused? No. So the next set of studies we looked at were those from the from clinics where they looked at records from kids who had come in. And there were huge numbers of these studies, and we looked at them, and we found that, in fact, the variation in the rates of children that denied was huge. It went from something like 4% to 96%. The percentage of recantation, the variation was huge. It went from something 4% to 30%. So I said, how come? And so what we did is we set up a standard for what really good studies are, where we were pretty convinced that these actually included children who had been abused. And when we do that, we see that in most studies, the average denial rate is something like 15 to 20%. So about 80 to 85% of children who are asked, were you ever abused, will say yes. And very few of those will, in fact, ever take it back. So in this case, we have these children, these two children, who are denying and denying and denying. And, you know, the common wisdom would say, well, it's because they're ashamed and embarrassed. But the scientific evidence says this is an unusual pattern, and you have to start to investigate other reasons why the children are denied.
Well, do the patterns of disclosure you've been discussing, do they, does it affect if the suspect is a close family?
Right. So, in fact, I think that this accommodation syndrome was originally for when there was it was incest and it was a family member, which would maybe make more sense about why one would keep it a secret and why one would deny. And the literature is a little bit mixed on this, but you know there are some patterns that children may be more likely to deny if it's a family member. But in this case, it's not a family member. It's a neighborhood child that the children probably might not have seen for really a long time. So that's the evidence doesn't support the notion that children deny if it's not a family member.
So now let me ask you, you've set out in broad strokes for the state of the research, and you mentioned briefly the application of that in this case, but can you explain to the jury in more detail how the research, which you've described, is affected by the facts of this case as to the ultimate reliability of these reports?
Well, what, in my expert opinion in terms of analyzing this, is that the children's reports were unreliable due to the suggestive nature in which they were elicited.
Okay, well then let's talk about suggestibility.
Right.
So you said now that you think the suggestive nature, but what is suggestibility?
Okay. So most people think that suggestibility is just simply asking misleading questions. You know, isn't it true that Andy made you touch his TT? But when one goes through transcripts, one sees that, you know, they're not necessarily filled with these kinds of questions. And Steve and I have a model. And our model is that interviewer bias is the central core of what determines or drives suggestibility. And here are the characteristics of biased interviews. The first is that the purpose of the interview is to confirm primary beliefs about the occurrence of an act. That's it. You get the kid in there, you have an idea in your head what you think happened, you want the kid to confirm that idea. That's what biased interviewers do. The second thing is that because they collect confirmatory evidence only, they don't ask about other things, or they don't pay attention to other things. It's that they only want to bring in those facts that confirm their case. And in doing that, they fail to test alternative hypotheses. They fail to ask, why is the child saying what they're saying? In this case, you know, you can look around, you can see a million reasons why the kid would be saying what they were saying. And in doing so, they ignore discrepant evidence. So that's what our core is in terms of this. And let me tell you, to be a biased interviewer, you do not have to be a professional. Parents can be biased interviewers. Teachers can be biased interviewers. It's what that belief system is. And there's not a cutoff. I mean, all of us have beliefs and about things that we always interject into our way of questioning the world. But we're open in terms of testing hypotheses, of paying attention to discrepant evidence. And the really biased interviewers are those who fail on this.
Okay, so now you talked a little bit about suggestibility, and you talked a little bit about interviewer bias. So I think it would be helpful if what you could do is explain in more detail the suggestive questioning techniques and interviewer bias that was present in this case.
Right. So here, just let me just show you this. The reason we think interviewer bias is really important is biased interviewers use highly suggestive techniques when they interview someone, that's what I'm going to talk about. And this can lead to false assents that sometimes become true beliefs. And sometimes the child says no, but the interviewer thinks the child says yes. So this is why it's so important. Now, in terms of the present study, these are the techniques that I've started to talk about. And I think it's important to note that this idea of contagion really spills over into all aspects of the case. There are two families, live on the same block, girls play together. One of the mothers is kind of the queen bee. And one can't ignore that in trying to figure out what's going on. So we can go through these one by one, but let's just start with repeated interviews. This is what people do, is they repeat interviews until child says what they want. And the scientific evidence for that is murky. I mean, I think it's clear that repeated suggestive interviews bring a child over to making false assents, to elaborating these false assents with many kinds of details. And with time, they become more and more spontaneous. So it really does become a script or a scenario for them. And we have very clear evidence for that. Now, some people say, well, you know, repeated interviews are important because it gives a child time to remember. I mean, all of us, you know, we say, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. That's true. And sometimes that is important. But it loses its value if it takes place in a suggestive interview. So those are important. And as we've seen here, the two girls that we know of were repeatedly and suggestively interviewed by mom, by therapists, and so on. So that's one part. The second, stereotype induction. So I think Steve Cici and Michelle Leishman are the kings of that study, of that area of research. And the point is that you can subtly suggest to children or to adults the character of someone. You know, he's a bad person, he's sneaky, he cheats. And they may never have met that person, or they might have met that person. But those kinds of characterizations, after a while, can creep in to a child's false report. So it could be what we see with Janie, the first child, is that she really has nothing bad to say about it, Andy. She loves Andy. Andy plays computer games with him. He's fun. She misses him. And then, you know, as she goes into therapy and it goes on, she starts to become more afraid of him. He starts to do more and more things to her. And in fact, what happens is by trial, Janie says that she took a shower with him. This is the one who said in therapy, at least he didn't make me take a shower. But, you know, he becomes the bad guy who takes a shower. And certainly there was this area of vilification of the bad things that Andy did. So that's a powerful technique.
Okay, you now next mentioned emotional tones.
Right.
Can you explain that, please?
Well, I think that what we see here a lot is this selective reinforcement that's tied up with rewards, especially for the two children in that one family. If you read carefully the mother's descriptions of what went on, there was a lot of gain for these children to disclose to their mother and their father. They could stay up late, they got to sit on their mother's lap, they were told that they were brave. And we know from studies that in fact, or first of all, we know, as any good psychologists know, it's really important to reinforce, reward people for their behaviors. But what we see in these cases is the idea of selective reinforcement. So we only reinforce things that we think are really good, and we ignore things that we're totally not interested in. And what children learn over very, very quickly is this pattern, that if I do this, if I say this, I'll get rewarded for it. And very quickly, their behavior can change over. This is certainly, you know, behavior therapy, behavior analysis is what it's all based on. But in terms of children's false allegations or testimony, we also see this happens. If the interviewer is saying, "That's great, I'm so proud of you," if the mother rewards the child in certain ways by giving them toys and taking them on, this is when these false allegations or these allegations start to emerge after long lines of denial. So that's what the emotional tone is.
And we've talked about this in general terms, but did you see evidence of selective reinforcement around threats and rewards in this case?
Right. So what I saw that was memorable was after these children, for a period of time, almost a year and a half, had denied, and the mom was then kind of forced by the DA to question them, that it was very rewarding. She was very rewarding. And when these children started to, and I don't know, I don't have the transcripts, but it's very clear about, you know, how she was hugging them and how they were sitting on her lap, and one child would see the other one sitting on her lap and say, "I want to sit on your lap too." And, well, you know, Jane, she's telling me the story of what happened with Andy. And, you know, before you know it, this kid, she wants that attention also. We also know that at the very end, which is that youngest child really had tremendous behavior problems, was a real attention seeker. And so I see that that's what's going on in this case.
Okay, and your last two points have to do with the effects of peers. One is peer pressure, and the other is peer contamination. Can you explain the role of that?
Right. So peer pressure is just saying, you know, your friends have told us, now it's your turn, and so on. And clearly, this went on in this trial. I mean, these children were told what the other children had said, and there is this Me Too kind of behavior that happened to them, and they're getting attention, it's a good thing for me to say it also. It's very, very clear in this case. But the more interesting one is peer contamination, and I'm going to talk about this more later. But this work was really initially begun with Steve Cece's postdoc, Gay Principe, and it's really fascinating. What we've learned is that children pass rumors false rumors onto other children in ways that we don't really know because they kind of just through their own in kinds of interactions. And if you ask them later about whether they actually experienced or actually saw those things, the children who, so we have the children who are the rumor givers, we have the children who are the suggested, they're getting the suggestion of the rumor from their peers, that those children will come to say, yes, that happened to me, and yes, I saw it. And I have to tell you, of all this was probably one of the more surprising findings I've had, because I've done lots of work in classrooms, and my idea was kids really don't talk, at this age, they don't really talk to each other. But they do talk to each other, and they do start to incorporate events. And we know from more naturalistic kinds of studies, such as sniper attacks on schools, that children who are not even at school that day will come to claim that they were there and they were hiding behind a building and so on. So this has a tremendous amount of power, and my opinion played a very big role in terms of how these allegations became instantiated.
All right, and Dr. Brook, let me switch topics. I want to now ask you a little bit about adult memories of conversation with children. And so can you explain to the jury what the research tells us?
Right. So in this case here, one of the most important, or there are two very important interviews that we don't have videotapes of, but we only have adults' reports of. It's the grandmother who talks about what Janie said to her 24 hours later, and the mother who kind of talks a little bit about what she said to Janie that night when she came home. And it's very important to know, in fact, how that information came out. So I just want to give you a slide here. So here, if you look at B, let's start with B. The adult says, what happened at school today? The child comes and says, the man with the mustache touched me. Gee, pretty spontaneous. It comes out. But if it comes out in this way, I think that we would start, from everything I've said, start to, in fact, think, you know, maybe this child is being led by the mom, and this is what he's coming out with because it's her belief that something happened. So how do we know about that? So I guess the common idea is, well, why don't we just ask the mother or the grandmother and say, well, you know, like, how did this conversation come about? Did you ask her these questions? Did she ever say no? And that was a question that we had based on a lot of the early trial work we did, was how good are adults' memories of conversations? And this was certainly at a time when a lot people weren't doing a lot of videotaping of interviews with children, so we really couldn't see how suggestive they were, and we were guessing because of notes and stuff like that. So we and a lot of other people started to do these studies of mothers' memories of conversations with children, studies of social workers' interviews with children, studies of trained forensic workers' memories from notes that they were taking, what they were able to recall from these conversations. And in all these studies, basically what happens is they're interviewing the child about a specific event. This interview is taking place, and later on we question them about, you know, tell us what happened. And so we're interested in, first of all, do they get the content right? And second of all, do they get it right about how the information is elicited? Can they accurately say, he just jumped out and said it? Do they say, no, I had to ask him a lot of questions. I remember that he was really resistant, which would be good, you know, would be interesting. And what we found is, and this is across all these studies, that in terms of content, there are errors that are made that sometimes reflect the bias of the interviewer. They're not a lot, but enough that it does, in fact, make a report inaccurate. major kind of error we found were omissions, where just, you know, and you can just tell this sometimes where you get a report that's, you know, a paragraph long and you know the interview's been an hour. Like, what are they omitting? And what's getting in? Well, what's getting in is A, what they think is important, and everything else, you know, it's like it either they don't want to put it in, they forget about it, and it doesn't get in. But the other thing that's really important is that they cannot correctly identify the degree to which the questions, to which the child's statements are elicited by leading questions, or they come out spontaneously. I mean, they are a chance level. They are really, really, really poor at this. And one of our studies with mothers, we asked them 24 hours later, and they were just had no idea. There was one study that was done here. I think that the social workers were questioned 10 to 15 minutes after the interview. And they were asked what the child said. And then the question was, well, did you ask any leading questions? And the overwhelming response is, no, we never use leading questions. Where you go back to the transcript and you see 80% of the questions were leading. So clearly, when you're missing, when you have to take all of this into account when you look at people's recall on the stand or even their written reports from later. Now, I just want to say that this is a fallibility of our memory. I mean, we know that, you know, what we cannot retain verbatim information for more than a few seconds, that kind of slowly dissolves, gets forgotten, gets rendered into some kind of gist. So just the way the system is built, that we don't really, it would be unexpected for someone to remember a whole conversation in a dialogue form. But I think that what this goes to show is how you evaluate evidence that's based upon memories of conversation. So we have the grandmother's transcript. And there are many things in that grandmother's transcript that are highly questionable. It's that out of nowhere, she asks, Andy comes into the conversation. Like, why does Andy come into the conversation? I mean, Andy, you know, babysat one or two times a year ago. How did that get in there? Why is the grandmother concerned about the child asking the question, why do boys shake their titi? I mean, it sort of seems to me like, you know, like a question that little girls are going to ask. But yet, somehow or other, it emerges into this huge allegation. And I think that there's, and I don't know how much the defense went into that, but there's huge amounts of information that's packed into that report. And so what's really important is that you have to understand how these allegations get started, and we're totally missing that information for this first little girl.
All right, well, so finally, let me turn to and ask you several general questions, and then I'll finish it up with one final one. So what's the long-term impact of suggestive questioning?
It's very long. You know, typically, I mean, I'll tell you, in the laboratory, our studies are involve giving children or adults suggestions, and then maybe going back 2 or 3 weeks later and then re-questioning them. And that's when those are the outcomes of our studies. I've done some study where we did minimal amounts of suggestion, and then 18 months later went back and questioned children in their middle childhood years, and we found remnants of misinformation effects later. And remember, that was one interview. So, you know, I would think that when you have many suggestive interviews, that these memories stay on. And we have evidence that, probably more anecdotal, that at sometimes these memories become false memories, and they truly become part of one's autobiographical memory. So the general rule is, once tainted, always tainted.
Okay, so now let me ask you, as a scientist in this, how would you interpret changes in the content of a child's testimony or accounts of an event over time?
Right. So this is what happened in this case. These little, especially these little girls, who, you know, went from nothing happened to maybe touch me on top of my pants, saying it happened one time, it happened eight times, it happened in summer, it happened in winter, and there's lots of inconsistencies. And there are two ways to look at the inconsistencies, very much like the repeated interviewing, that reports do change over time just as a function of normal memory. Sometimes we forget things, and we then sort things out over time and say, no, you know, it really happened that way, and we put that in. So it could be writing wrong information. It could be just due to forgetting. So you don't mention the same information over a period of time because you've forgotten about it. But it also seems that with repeated interviewing and repeated suggestive interviewing, that if you look at the contents of the reports after each of those suggestive interviews, the content changes. And sometimes it changes more than it stays the same. So a lot of times, so my interpretation, or I can say one interpretation is that when children give inconsistent reports that are associated with repeated suggestive interviews, that the inconsistent reports are a result of these repeated suggestive interviews.
Yes, let's imagine then a case like this one, where a child is given varying accounts of the same event in multiple interviews. So when you're faced with that situation, what does the research say about which would be the most reliable report?
Right. So the general rule is, it's the first interview, with the caveat that it's the first interview that's the most important, unless that interview contains suggestion, or unless that interview was preceded with suggestion. But if it's a case where, you know, the mom hears something or they're concerned about something, and it's the child is taken to be interviewed, and the child makes a statement during that interview, it's that statement that's really the most important.
Okay, so in this case, what did you find significant about the first report from the index child?
Well, the first report is to the grandmother. And I can't tell you very much about it because I don't know what actually happened in that interview. So the first child is somewhat of a mystery. But we know that she added onto that in the second interview, and black box with her. But I do want to hypothesize that there was a community belief before that talk with her grandmother that Andy was somewhat of a strange babysitter, and one has to take that into account.
And so, two final questions. First, in your expert opinion, what were the major factors present in this case which could impact the reliability of these accounts that Andy uses?
Right. So the first thing is that were these factors here that were characteristics. The second was a characteristic of delay in interviewing, that first child, Janie, they waited 5 days between the time the grandmother saw her and she went to social services, which is a tremendous amount of time, where especially it seems if you have a hysterical mother, one wonders about how much went on there during that point. Another important factor is the age of these children. These children were very young. They were 5 and under. And we know that these children, this age group, is under many circumstances very, very prone to suggestion. Especially what we have here are the major suggestors seem to be the parents. And just this willing to comply and to please could play a very important factor.
All right, so Dr. Brooke, finally, let me sort of cut to the chase and go to the bottom line here. As an expert in memory suggestibility, based upon all the information that you've reviewed in this case, did these factors which you discussed taint the reliability of the statements of the children that Andy uses?
It is my expert opinion.
Objection, reading the script.
by these rulings, both the courts, of the scope of what the expert is allowed to testify. I would ask that the answer she gave be stricken.
There's nothing to strike at this point.
You're right, but I'm new at this. Whatever she's going to say, let it be pre-struck.
Can I answer?
Well, I'm going to test it, yes.
Okay, you should. The judge
is out of the room, so.
So,
you can give a proffer.
Mr. Prosecutor, I am not talking about credibility. The expert witness is not allowed to give opinions about the ultimate truth of children's suggestions, of children's statements. I don't know what happened to these children. No one knows what happened to these children. All I'm telling you is I'm talking about reliability, which is the context in which these statements were elicited. And my evidence goes to the fact that the contexts in which they were elicited have a high risk of producing unreliable false allegations. Now, whether they're true or not, that's for the jury to decide. But I want to give the jury this evidence about how before making their decision, and they can take it or they can leave it. But I am not talking about whether I believe the children or whether I think they're lying.
Thank you, Dr. Brock. Please answer any questions the prosecution might have.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross.
Afternoon.
You're being paid for your work in public schools.
Yes, I am.
I see. By the defense counsel?
By the family, yes.
Okay. Wouldn't you consider yourself then a hired gun?
No. Why? No, I'm not a hired gun. I came to give a testimony that was based upon my scientific knowledge. I was not told what to say.
I see. So you make the proffer that you were arguing impartial information or impartial opinion.
I tried my best.
Is it true in the past, though, that you tended to be hired by the defense?
That's true.
Okay. Are you a clinical psychologist?
No, I'm not.
What is your PhD in?
Developmental psychology.
I see. Does that involve any clinical training, like the evaluation of children who might be suffering from child abuse?
No.
I see. So you haven't had a chance to evaluate the specific children in this case to find out if they're showing signs of having suffered from child abuse?
No, I never evaluate children involved in a case.
In fact, you don't have that training?
I've never evaluated a child for sexual abuse.
Okay, so the question I have is, what expertise do you bring then to a case that involves child abuse?
Okay, so I'm bringing knowledge about normal development. In the field of child sexual abuse, there are two kinds of avenues of research. One avenue is when children suffer traumatic events, how accurately do they recount those events? And that's a very big field, an important field of research. There's also another field of research that asks the question, is it possible for children to come up with narratives of events that they've never experienced? And that's what my research is about. And to do that research, you don't have to be a clinician. You really have to be an experimental psychologist.
Okay, and this research includes all the components that you're talking about here in terms of a suggestive interview.
That's correct.
I see. What's the typical experience or event that a child might make up as a result of this research? What sorts of events are they led to talk about that didn't happen?
In my research?
In research.
Well, there's large variation in it. Some of it can be a trip to the zoo, a visit with a magician. Some of it can be a medical examination. And sometimes it actually involves more traumatic medical interventions that sometimes involve general urinary functions and so on.
Mm-hmm. But most of the time, the typical event, that is the event that the bulk of the research focuses on, is sort of like a trip to the zoo. Let's say a fun event that may have occurred in a child's past.
That's right.
Okay. And another way to put that is, except for that last type of research that you talked about, you're not talking about situations where children have been induced in research to say anything as traumatic, or report anything as traumatic, or as important as child abuse or sexual abuse.
Well, as an academic, which you were, I understand.
In a different life.
I think you would know that this would be unethical to try to plant these memories into children. But we have also done studies where we have asked children planted suggestions about events that, were they to happen, would result in some concern, such as Mr. Science putting something yucky in a child's mouth, such as having someone touch them or hug them, medical interventions that never happened. So there is evidence, a great deal of evidence, that we can bring children to make inaccurate statements about bodily harm or other kinds of disturbing events.
Okay, but the bulk of the research, though, tends to be on a different type of topic.
It's certainly easier to do, yes.
Okay. Have any of these studies involved dealing with children who actually have suffered child abuse?
Well, no. And, a few have, but let me go back to my original division of the literature. As a researcher, I don't know what it would tell you to put children who were really abused into these studies. What we want to know is, do children who haven't experienced an event, can we bring them to provide a narration of that event? So there have been some people who have looked at sexually abused children because they want to know, is there something different about their memory systems or so on. But those studies do not add to the kind of evidence I'm talking about today.
I see. Now, when children are placed in these studies, do they all react to these various factors in the same way?
No.
Or do some fall prey to the suggestion rather quickly and others resist it?
That's true. There's huge variation. I think the general rule is that there's huge variation. I mean, there are some children you can talk till you're blue, and they're not going to wink at you. They're not going to give you a smile, and they'll say, "No, it never happened. It never happened." There are some children, you can just start the question, and they're going yes. I mean, those are the two extremes, and we don't know very much about the psychological factors that predict that other than age. But I can tell you that the more suggestive the interviews, the more of these kinds of components that are packed into it, the more coercive, the more the rewards. You can certainly get very high rates of suggestion.
But it doesn't determine everything.
Well, it's never going to be 100%. Well, mind you, actually, I'll show you a slide where we've gotten 100%. But, I can tell you this. Asking a leading question, it's not going to do it. You might get it in a laboratory where the kid might say yes by mistake, okay? And you can do this. But, you ask a leading question, it's really not going to take a lot of have a huge effect on memory distortion. It's really the compilation of these characteristics that make the difference.
I see, but there are children who resist.
There are children who resist.
Okay, have you done any sort of evaluations of the resistance powers, let's call it, of Jamie?
No.
Nancy?
I've never seen these children.
Okay. So we don't know what their individual reaction might have been to these types of experiments, with even if these factors were turned up, let's say.
No.
Okay. So how can this stuff you talked about today be relevant if we don't know about the individual portion of this, the potential resistance of Jenny, Nancy, and Rosie?
Well, these are general principles that are here to guide the jury in making a decision, to dispel any common disbeliefs or misinformation that they might have, to give them a framework for understanding about why it could be possible for these children to come to make these allegations. Certainly, my opinion is not that, you know, this child, given everything I know about it, this child is really suggestive. I can't tell you that, but I can tell you in general, based upon the psychological principles that are based upon replicated studies that have been done for maybe 20 years, that these principles hold. But certainly they're not there to make for specificity.
Yeah, that is, there is still a possibility that they may have hold in this case.
Absolutely.
Is there another possibility that even though if we stipulate the methods were suggestible, that it might have actually suggested the children into telling the truth as opposed to making things up?
Yes, and here we go. Because, I mean, we have done this experiment. If you suggestively interview children about events that have actually happened to them, about events that they don't want to talk about, those methods work really well. You can get them to go no, no, yes, and then to start to give you information. And that's probably why they're used, because they're good. It gets the kid talking, okay? But the problem is that we don't know and we don't have any tools to determine in a courtroom case, because we don't know whether the event happened or not, that whether these tools are producing that statement and whether the statement is true or false. So what we have to go on is that what are the risks of using this? And the risks are that there's a high degree of probability that they could provoke false allegations. And yes, it's true that it could break down the resistance of these children to tell what really happened. But given all the other factors in this case, given the peer pressure and the contamination and the contagion and the roles of the mother and the fact that these kids didn't tell for a long period of time and the fact that they're starting to tell different stories, I mean, I think you have to put all of that's kind of the totality of the evidence that you have to put together.
But yes or no, and I'll end with this. It sounds like what you're saying, the scientific evidence is telling us either that we're in a situation where pressure was applied and the child made up a story, or pressure was applied and the child started to tell the truth. And science cannot tell us which one of those two, yes or no, science cannot tell us with certainty which of those two situations are.
Well, for one of the children, we can say that that child never actually acceded to the suggestion. She said it never happened, and she said it never happened to her sister. So, you know, there are extraneous facts that help us delineate what the science, what we can presume or not presume. But yes, it's certainly a point.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have 5 minutes? Okay. So, you know, I've made all these grand statements, science shows us, blah, blah, blah. And when I testify in a courtroom, this is exactly what I do. I do not really talk about any specific studies, give numbers, give details, give methods. But because most of you do have a behavioral science background, I thought I would just kind of whiz through and show you a few of the highlights of the studies that a lot of us have relied on to provide this kind of testimony. So here's this part of the talk, which is usually a general psychology colloquium, but you'll get in the fast way. So what I want to tell you about is that our child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome paper was spearheaded by Cami London. And it was, in fact, to look at the degree to which there was evidence for these three different stages of so-called disclosure. And we looked at 13 studies that were these retrospective studies of asking adults about what happened to them. And it was really quite amazing that in the sample that we got, that only 10% of them said that the abuse had been reported to authorities. Now, my feeling is that maybe they didn't remember because they were adults when this happened, but I think it does tell us that there is a tip to the iceberg of real silence, that there are lots and lots of children who are being harmed that never come forward. But there are problems with this study because we don't know if the children were actually questioned, which is the issue that comes up when I testify. We don't know very much about the accuracy of memory. I mean, certainly John Schooler has made the case of, you know, when someone was said, this is the first time I've ever told you, and then they go back and realize this person has told people many times over the past few years. So it's kind of, they're both autobiographical memory. And there's also issues about the validity of report. But even if you factor all this in, I think it is true that we do have a problem, and it's a social problem of not reporting. Now, in terms of we've done this survey twice. This is the latest survey, and there should be a CC in here, but I didn't know where the caret was to put it in. So, okay. And I think that what was important here is that we found this huge rate. And what's really interesting is when you look at experts who go to court who want to testify about this, they say, "Oh, children always deny." And they, what do they rely on? They rely truly on the very worst studies, studies where it was clear that these were children who made false allegations at the behest of their interviewers. And there's no attempt to really look at the goodness of the methodology. So we did that, and when we did that, we found these pretty low rates of both retrospective. Okay, so here's a study of interviewer bias, because I just want to show you how insidious it is. In this study, we had 30 real subjects who were in training to become social workers interviewers. And each of them was sent out to a school to interview four different children. And they were told that they were to interview the children to find out about a special event that happened when a stranger came to the school a while ago. And what actually happened was that the first three children they interviewed all participated in the same activity, which was a surprise birthday party. And there were many activities in the birthday party, and you know, some of them were non-script consistent, things that usually don't happen in a birthday party, and things were consistent. So the first three children that they interviewed all had the same event to tell. And we never told we gave the interviewers no strategies or whatever. The only thing I told them is don't let the kids draw. But some of them still did. So they interviewed these three kids. They were allowed to make notes about what the kids said. And then the fourth child that they interviewed, and there were 120 children, because every interviewer interviewed four children, and that was it. The fourth child came into a room with another child, and they sat and they colored for 20 minutes or so. There was no party. It was the one of the assistants' birthday, so they sang happy birthday. They didn't sing happy birthday in the first one. But that was essentially it. I mean, there was one other activity that was common between the two. So then the interviewers were finished, and they made notes. And then at the very end of these interviews, which was about an hour, we then asked them to tell us what the special event was. And then we went back about 2 weeks later, and we did some memory testing Again, about what the special event was, and then about which children said what, because we're interested in could they keep them straight. So the idea of this is the first three children were there to set up a bias that there was a birthday party. So what do we find? So the first thing is that when we looked at what the children said, the fourth child made many more inaccurate statements than the first three children. But what were these statements about? Was it, you know, I went to a birthday party? And what we found is that, in fact, 60% of the fourth child said that they went to a birthday party. And this was picked up primarily through suggestive questions from the interviewer, but in a few cases, it seems that they got it from the classroom, because other kids in the classroom had gone. And so we have our peer tainting there. But in fact, 60% had picked it up. And for a lot of that, we attribute that to interviewer bias. But 40% of the kids said, no, I never went to a birthday party. What do the interviewers remember? Except for one, all of the interviewers said all the children attended and participated in a surprise birthday party. But 40% didn't. And so what's going on? And they say, well, you know, the fourth child was particularly quiet. She was shy. She really didn't want to talk to me. All the kids did different kinds of things, but it was clear they all went to the same birthday party. And there was only one who said, you know, it was a stooge. The fourth child was a stooge. He got it pretty right, not exactly right. So here what you see happens is that you have this buildup of a bias that by the time the fourth child comes along, they kind of go into a stream of all these different kinds of suggestive leading questions. And some of the kids, 60%, say, yes, it happened. But 40% say no. Well, what do the interviewers do? The interviewers, in fact, make the report that it is yes. So you can have this bias that's strong enough not only to elicit a suggestive interview, but to change one's own memory or one's own interpretation of the fact of what happened. So there's that. Here's an effect of repeated interviewing. Here's one where we suggested that a thief came into the classroom and stole food. And we suggested that the child was in a park and with his friends and helped a lady find her monkey, and they got treats. And there was a true event that actually happened where someone came into the school and needed help to get to the nurse's office or the principal's office. And this child took them, and while they were going, the person fell down and they had to help them. And the other one was a true punishment that happened in the school or at home that they told us about. And so we had the first interview where we just said to this child, to each of the children who were 3 and 4 year olds, did this ever happen? And if they said yes, we'd say, tell us about it. That was it. And then we had the next two that were highly suggestive interviews where we put in as many suggestive factors as we could, because what we were interested in actually was the narratives that the children came, but it went something like this. This is one of the sections of the script. So we're actually telling them about what the other kids have told us, that they were in the park and a lady helped them find a monkey. And we say to the kid, has that ever happened to you? And this child said no. But then we say, we come in with the other kids told us, but I want to hear it from you. And this kid says yes. And you said, you did, I thought so, tell me everything. And she told me to find her monkey, and she told me that her monkey went to the high school. And was there anything else? And we keep priming them. And then at the end, we give them lots of feedback about how wonderful it is. And then if the kids deny, we say, okay, well, what I want you to do is just pretend. We'll ask you some questions. And then we go back in the third. And then there are subsequent interviews after that. And in the last interview, we just go in, another person comes in and just says, listen, you know, I've been hearing these stories and I want to know if any of these things happened to you. So what we can trace is what these repeated interviews do. And this here shows you the percentage of assents. And I want you to look at the red line. So you can see that at the beginning, maybe one child says yes, but with no details. By the second interview, it goes up to about 40-50%. And by the third interview, we're at 85%. And by the end of the interview, the end of the study, all kids are assenting for the same rate for the true and the false. This is what the prosecutor asked me about. Look at the punished true, which is the green line. These kids said, no, I never got sent out into time out. No, I didn't call Gabrielle fat. She called me fat. And you can see they really hang on to that for two times. And then we push them up. So you can use these techniques to get kids to talk about things they don't want to talk about. What's interesting about this study is that the quality of the narratives also change. And what you can see is that at the very beginning, the kids really are not giving you very much, except for the true event. And that doesn't change much over the study. So this here is repeated interviewing about a true event, kind of stays the same. Same thing with the punished true event. But what happens with the false stories is it goes through the ceiling. It goes through the ceiling. These stories are incredibly detailed. They're incredibly elaborated. And one of the reasons is because they can say whatever they want. You know? I mean, for a true event, it's sort of like, well, you know, you've got to stay with it. You've got to play in the sandbox. But here, you really don't have to. And these are really quite incredible interviews. Some of them have many bizarre details. Certainly, the false stories have more bizarre than the true. But the other thing you find out with the true is that as interviewing goes on, they start inserting bizarre, inaccurate details also. And then here, this last one just tells you about the spontaneity of the comments over this period of interviews. And usually people think, you know, well, spontaneity is a landmark of these experienced ones. But what you see is that for the false events, the kids are incredibly spontaneous. So repeated interviewing does have and this one here is what I was telling you about selective reinforcement. This is done by Jim Wood and his student Garvin. And what they would is they send Paco into the classroom, and he plays with the kids, and he reads them a story. He has glasses on, and then they interview them. And there's one group of kids who gets these selective interviews. And they're asked, did Paco take you someplace in a helicopter? The kid says no. They say, you're not doing good. And then they ask the next question, did Paco break a toy? Yes. Great. You're doing excellent now. And they go through about 15 or 16 questions like that. The control condition are just asked these yes, no questions. Okay? So the first thing they find is that the yes assents for the selective group goes, as you trace them through the interview, more and more kids are saying yes. But the important thing is what happens a week later when they just simply ask them, did this ever happen? And you look at the purple line, that what's interesting is that when they're just saying, you know, did this really happen, that 45% of the kids who are in the selective condition are saying, yes, it happened. And the kids who just got the leading questions by themselves are really not saying anything. So that's a really important study. And let me just end with this one, because I just think it's, you know, this was the home in which it, and this is one of Gay Principe's studies, Steve was on it also, it's called Mumfrey Comes to School. And a magician comes to school with the rabbit, tries to pull the rabbit out of the hat. Of course, there's no rabbit, it's failed. Later, kids are lined up in a hall, ready to go in the classroom, and they hear the teacher say, I heard that Magic Mumfrey messed up during his show and couldn't pull the rabbit out of the hat. Well, I heard that the rabbit got loose in the school and is eating carrots. Okay, so there's a group of kids who hear the rumor, okay? And these are called, there's a group of kids who hear the rumor. There are a group of kids who also witness the carrots in the classroom, okay? Okay, these kids hear the rumor, and there are some kids who hear the rumor and they see the carrots. There's another group of kids who don't hear the rumor, but are classmates of the kids who hear the rumor. And then there are kids from another school who see the failed experiment, but that's it. A week later, they go back. They interview the kids with some suggestions. Some of them get suggestions, some of them don't. And then a week later, they go back and they're just simply asked to tell about what happened. So, okay, so I was wrong. So we have four groups of kids. We have kids who saw the carrots, kids who overheard the rumor, kids who were classmates of the kids who overheard the rumor, and these are kids from the other school. And what we see is that how many of these kids actually reported that the rabbit got loose and was eating carrots, and it's huge. I mean, it's like, oh, here's your 100%, okay? And the second group are kids who, in the first interview, were not interviewed suggestively. And again, all the witnesses say it happened. What's interesting here is that the classmates are more prone to report that this happened and that they saw it. And so this made Gabe actually hypothesize that maybe in certain circumstances, it's more suggestive to have a kid giving misinformation than an adult. And then finally, the last group are kids who got a suggestion in the previous interview. But I think that this is very, very powerful evidence about what the effect that peers can have on children's interviews. And that's it. I'm done. I hope I've convinced you that the following, that social scientists, people who are cognitive scientists, whatever we want to call ourselves, who do this kind of work and lots of other kinds of work, that we do have a role to play in society. In my special case, it's been for this part of my career in the courtroom before I was in the classroom. But you know, it's not like we can just sit back. We do these studies because they're initially spurred by some kind of general interest. And I'm not saying everybody has to run out. We all have different temperaments. We all have different kinds of wants and needs. I mean, the first time I testified, I swore I would never do it again. It was just horrible. It was just so depressing. And I just got sick. And it was terrible. Somehow or other, I wandered back in. And I can't say that I like going into the courtroom. I told someone before, I didn't like to be questioned by these two men today. So, you know, what can I? It's not pleasant. But I hope that it's useful. And I think that and the important thing is to try to present the scientific knowledge, the good scientific knowledge, as simply and as honestly as possible to elucidate these matters. And I think that there are lots of areas that we all deal with where we can do this. So the second part was to show you that there really was science. It wasn't that I just went in and say, well, it's clear this is what happened. This is based on lots and lots and lots of science. So I thank you, and I hope we have lots of time for questions.